welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today, I'm going to replay a show I did a while ago for Black History Month, but I wanted to add a couple of points to my introduction. In the spring of last year, during the beautiful uprising against the murder of Black people and other people of color by police, students at many universities confronted the history of their institutions and the fact that there were statues and portraits of enslavers and enablers of slavery at many of these schools. The book Ebony and Ivy goes deep into the role of the university. We're also going to hear Babavakian in an excerpt from Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. In the face of a fascist assault of the democratic form of rule in the U.S., many liberals and people on the left have clung to Jeffersonian democracy as the ideal for a just society. B.A. shreds this idea. So let's jump into it now and give a good hard listen. This is Black History Month, and today we're going to hear two segments that help tell the real story of American democracy, white supremacy, and slavery. In other words, the things that shaped U.S. society from the very beginning up to today. Now, I'd like to read a quotation from the book Basics from the talks and writings of Babavakian in order to help provide a theme and a framework for today's show, and really for Black History Month overall. It's the first quotation that opens the book up. "There would be no United States as we know it today without slavery. This is a simple and basic truth." This is a simple and basic truth, but I think it's a truth that many people don't get as deeply as we should. And one reason is that there's a lot of cover-up of the true history of this country and the foundational role of slavery from the very beginning. So we're going to do our best to uncover some of that truth. At the back end of the show, we'll hear an excerpt from a talk by Babavakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and that talk is entitled Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. All right, you can't talk about Jeffersonian democracy, and you can't talk about Jefferson without talking about slavery. And opening the show up, we're going to hear a conversation I had with someone I had really been looking forward to talking to. I read his book and then read it again. It's one of those books that drives you nuts because you're reading it and you're thinking, damn, sometimes you just feel like there's so much that you don't know, so much that's kept hidden from you and hidden from the view of everyone. So I spoke with Craig Stephen Wilder. Craig is a professor of American history at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and has taught at Dartmouth and Williams College as well. He's the author of the book Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. It's an extremely powerful book, and as I said, it's a book that lays bare uncomfortable truths about race, slavery, and the American Academy. Here's the interview I did a little while back, so enjoy. So I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Craig Stephen Wilder. Craig, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start by me telling you again, emphasizing that this book just blew my mind. I mean, it was, you know, I started off and I thought, wow, this is going to be a dense book. Mm-hmm. And it is, and rightfully so. At the same time, there's some points in there that really punch you. And I thought that was something that I really wanted to dig into. And so I was wondering, and we'll start that in a minute, but I was wondering how you came to this book, because the idea of exploring, particularly someone who's currently, you may not come from, but you're currently enmeshed in this whole elite university scene, right? And that you come and you're kind of biting the hand that feeds you, right?
Yeah, to a certain extent. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, look, I think this started in 2002. It started a long time ago. And I was going, as you mentioned, I was teaching at Williams College. I had just gotten hired at Dartmouth. And I had set out a small project. I just wanted to write an article that was going to explain how it was that Black abolitionists, free Black people in the Northeast, managed to enter the professions since they couldn't go to college. And it's a New England story. A lot of these kids are coming from as far away as Philadelphia and Baltimore to these New England towns to study with a friendly minister or a school that will accept just a few Black students. There's a lot of violence around that. But I became increasingly interested in the question of why they couldn't attend the colleges. In fact, you know, by that time, by the 1830s, for instance, Native Americans had actually been students on campus for almost 200 years. So it wasn't just race that was happening. It actually suggested that colleges had a much bigger role in shaping American society and in determining who was educable and who wasn't, and in shaping the politics of slavery and the politics of conquest. And so I started going back in time. I actually kind of forgot those essays that I was intending to write. And I went way back to the 17th and the 16th century and started looking at the origins of these colleges and the role that they played in the colonial world.
when you did that, and you begin your book by stating straight up that the founding, funding, and development of higher education in America was thoroughly entwined with the social and economic forces that were devastating, transforming, just, you know, causing untold human suffering, untold in the history of the world up to that point in terms of West and Central Africa and what was happening there. Let's explore this a little. You said that human slavery was actually the precondition. It wasn't just something that accompanied, but it was the precondition for the rise of higher education in the Americas.
Yeah. And, you know, let's look at the institutions we know and watch them on the ground. Harvard is established in 1636. It's the first college in the British colonies. There are already colleges in the Spanish colonies. New Spain has colleges. Catholic priests are establishing colleges in the Dominican Republic. What's the Dominican Republic today? Mexico, Peru. The very first college in the Americas is established in Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic in 1536, about 100 years before Harvard. When Harvard is established in 1636, the relatively weak Puritan colony of Massachusetts is establishing a college in part to evangelize Native Americans. A major goal of the college is actually to wage sort of cultural warfare against Native people, to convert Native children to Christianity. It's a system of evangelicalism or evangelizing and transformation that would create generational divisions, linguistic and other cultural crises, so that the mechanisms of power and conquest were not just military. They were also educational, they were religious, they were cultural. But to pay for that project, Harvard actually turns increasingly to New England's commercial relationship with the West Indies. As one Harvard historian confesses, Samuel Eliot Morison, in the 20th century, it's the West Indies, it's Barbados that saves New England. New England is a faltering colony until, in fact, it establishes itself as the commercial supplier, the merchant suppliers to the West Indian plantations, where the wealthiest men in the British Atlantic live. And so they begin supplying Barbados and the other British West Indian islands with everything they need, from fish to vegetables to wood to build barrels to carry rum out of those plantations, the cheap fish that's actually used, salted dried fish used to feed enslaved Africans on those plantations. That's how they make their money. And Harvard follows that trade so that the college begins using that commercial network to recruit wealthy students and donors from the West Indies in order to sustain itself and maintain its missions and fund its missions.
And it's amazing because one of the things that you detail, you know, very well is the fact that they actually chased after this. I mean, terms of this being sort of, and I want to explore first this economic level that we're on, but in terms of this being the economic foundation of these colleges, and there was a back and forth because on the one hand, they went and they sought out these slave traders and the merchants, you know, who were, you know, nobody wanted to talk about, well, we're dealing in human flesh, but that was actually what these universities very purposely went out and sought, was the people that had that kind of disposable income, if you will.
Historically, when we mention slavery at all in the context of the university, we tend to actually mention it as if it's just environmental, right? There happened to be slavery in the Atlantic world, and so, of course, there might be a slave or two on the Harvard campus. But in fact, the relationship is much more intentional than that. The universities, the college's trustees and its officers actually sought out the West Indians. They looked for them. They were searching for that money, and they were searching to formalize those relationships. There's an incredible moment that happens right after Harvard is founded. It's founded in 1636. The very next year, the Pequot War breaks out in southern New England and culminates in what's famously known as the Pequot Massacre, the destruction of hundreds of Pequot Indians. Hundreds of women and children are also taken captive, and they're put on a ship named the Desire and sent to the West Indies to be sold as slaves. That ship also returns with Africans. So it's the first slave ship to leave New England, and it's the first slave ship to return. Right after it returns, Harvard gets its first slave. In 1638, only 2 years after the college is founded, a man who's referred to as the Moor is on campus, and he's the slave of basically the headmaster of the school, and he's being used to take care of the rooms, take care of Harvard Yard. And, you know, we have to think about Harvard Yard as a relatively small collection of wood frame buildings. But the slave is there almost from the beginning. And in fact, actually, I think that's a perfect example of what happens across the history of American colleges. The enslaved Africans are always there. They're always on campus, and slave traders are always on the board.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Craig Stephen Wilder. And Craig is the author of the book Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. You had another aspect that you spoke about, too, in your book, which actually really got me, too, is you said the defend and regulate the colonies aspect of the ties that bind. That's what I took as a note. The defend and regulate their colonies aspect of the ties and bind. You called the schools actually imperial instruments akin to armies and forts. What are you talking about there?
What I'm talking about is you really have to look at why Harvard gets established. And you know, there are multiple reasons. There are multiple historical explanations for the establishment of colonial colleges. I think often we make the argument historically in the historiography that New England needed ministers. It needed well-trained Orthodox ministers. But in fact, actually, by 1636, the Puritan colony is only about 6 or 7 years old when Harvard is founded. It's only about 6 or 7 years old. Most of the people coming are adults. The adults are, in fact, actually the men, are, in fact, include a large number of college graduates, a large number of men who were trained at Cambridge. And so the urgency for a college isn't really that clear in 1636, especially given the other needs of the colony, feeding itself, defending itself, these really quite existential problems that it had. And so I think you have to ask some bigger questions about why it's established at that moment. And I would argue that the British colonialism in the Americas, like Spanish colonialism in the Americas and French colonialism in the Americas, actually operated on a model that had already been rehearsed in Europe. And in much the same way that in the 2 centuries before the first Englishman ever arrives in the Americas, the English crown had already used colleges in its attempts to conquer Ireland and Scotland. It had funded professorships. It had funded colleges. It had tried to wage cultural warfare to help establish religious orthodoxy so that it had other instruments than military power to achieve supremacy in those regions. What you see in the 17th century is the capacity of an emerging English empire to extend that power and extend that model of colonialism across the Atlantic world. And so not only is Harvard established in 1636, but in 1649, just 13 years later, the Parliament approves the New England Company, which is a missionary corporation for the purpose of evangelizing native people. And so when I said that you have to think about colleges like armies and forts, you actually have to think about them as instruments of cultural warfare. And while I know for a lot of people that sounds harsh, that's the role that they're actually playing in the colonial world. You know, there's a brilliant example of it that comes much later in the century, in the early 17th century, in two places, in New England and in Virginia, when they begin actually raising funds in England for the evangelization of Native Americans. And then the Brafferton Fund, the one that's used at the college in William and Mary to establish Brafferton Hall, the Indian college, the instructions actually include taking Native American children from friendly nations and kidnapping Native American children from unfriendly nations to train them up as ministers and then send back people of their own color and blood to evangelize and accelerate the process of cultural transformation. And so I would argue, in fact, that one of the primary roles of colleges in the colonial world is precisely that, to be on the front line of a cultural war that's happening between people who are fighting off conquest and the conquerors.
Mm-hmm. That's very heavy. And we'll get back to that towards the end of the discussion, because I think that there's actually some of that that applies as well today when you think about this. Well, let me first remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Craig Stephen Wilder, professor of American history at MIT and the author of a really fabulous book, a really powerful book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. And I have to ask you this, Craig, because it's very heavy when you're talking about this. You're talking about the Native American, the Native peoples here. And throughout your book, there's a constant sort of back and forth in terms of the relationship between the Native peoples and the enslaved African people.
Right.
Let's talk about that a little, because it seems to be a linchpin for a lot of what happens.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to do in the book, and I think I had to do it, in some ways, a book about slavery in colleges doesn't make sense until you look closely at Native American history. Or in other words, I asked the question as I was doing the research for this book. It took me 11 years, and there came this moment when I had to try and figure out, why were these tiny little colleges in need of so much money? Well, in other words, you know, they were turning to slave traders. They were turning to planters in the South and the West Indies to recruit students for donations, et cetera, to make these close cultural ties and institutional ties. You know, the Puritans in New England are looking to the Puritans in the West Indies for support. the Congregationalists at Yale are looking to Congregationalists in other parts of the Americas. And when the later colleges are established, they do something very similar. Immediately upon their establishment, they start turning to the West Indies and the South for money and students. And I was asking myself, why do these tiny little schools? Often, some of them actually don't have more than a dozen students, and they're lucky if they have a single faculty member. Why do they need so much money? And part of the answer is actually that they're not just there to educate the kids, the boys who are on campus. They're also there to play this role in the process of conquest and colonialism, this cultural role, this role in accelerating conquest and colonialism.
And you think about this, because you're talking again, I don't know, I mean, it's very happy. It's very...
Well, you know,
go ahead.
One of the things that's tied to that is I also didn't want to create this very romantic sense, you know, this sort of romantic history in which Africans, enslaved Africans and Native Americans are both oppressed people, and therefore they can't participate in each other's oppression, because in part of the mechanisms of colonialism actually often put their fates in conflict and mean that the very presence of one group is actually doing damage to the other.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, and we'll get back to that a little bit as we go along, too, because we've got a lot to talk about.
Okay.
I'm telling you, I was reading this book and read it again. I was like, no, damn, man, I should have had you for 2 days up in here, right? Okay, we're talking about slave traders in the backbone of the universities.
Yeah.
And again, they refer to themselves as merchants. But you also talk about, as you're talking about what's happening between the native peoples and the enslaved African peoples, you're talking about what's happening in society in general. But that actually, it wasn't just the foundation of these schools. Like they needed this, like, yo, where am I going to get the money to start up the school? I got to
go.
You don't like it, but I got to go do it, right?
Right.
Well, actually, the whole destiny of these schools, the development of these schools actually coincided with and depended a lot on how the slave trade was doing.
Right.
And it was really very much tied to the peaking of the slave trade represented the full flowering of these universities.
Right. In fact, actually, when I started to make that realization, I think you described it perfectly, that's when the book really came together. It was an 11-year project, and about 6 or 7 years into it, I was still struggling to try to figure out how to bring this story all together. And that became the key. There came a point when I really realized that, and just to describe it, in the British colonies, between 1636 and 1745, there are only three colleges, right? There's Harvard in Massachusetts, 1636. There's William and Mary in Virginia, 1693. And there's Yale College, the collegiate school, in Connecticut, 1701. And so those three colleges actually for, you know, basically 120 years are, in fact, the academic infrastructure of the British colonies. And then between 1745 and 1769, fewer than 25 years, less than a quarter century, seven new colleges get established. Codrington College in Barbados, and all of them fight about who was first. So I'm not going to get into that business, you know, because it's all just ego and foolishness. But Codrington College in Barbados, which we often leave out. We forget that Barbados is part of the British Atlantic world now. So it's Codrington in Barbados, the College of New Jersey, which is now Princeton, the College of Philadelphia, which is now the University of Pennsylvania, King's College, which is now Columbia, Queens College, which is now Rutgers, the College of Rhode Island, which is Brown, and Dartmouth College up in New Hampshire. But that 25-year period, when the number of colleges more than triples, that's when the slave trade is peaking in the Atlantic world. And all of these colleges and all of the denominations, the religious denominations that establish them, are turning to slavery and the slave trade to institutionalize their presences in the American colonies, to make a claim upon the American colonies by establishing churches, schools, colleges, libraries, hospitals, and the money for that institutional transformation is coming directly from the slave trade and slavery.
Hmm. You know, one of the things that you talk about as well, and you can see that the sort of the impact of all that and how that plays, and you have all these people going into these schools, and there's this idea of like, especially you have a country, you have an area where that is being colonized itself by Britain and various other forces, colonial forces in the world at the time. And you have this population, this settler population, if you will, that comes in and it's training its future generations. And a lot of what happened, I was really moved by the fact that you have a whole section in the book that talks about how these people were trained in a certain outlook and a certain whole way of looking, and particularly looking at African people. And it happened, too, with the Native peoples, because they were also called into. You look at all the wars that were fought against the Native peoples and how these various collegiate people went out and were the first ones to rush to kill the indigenous people in these wars. But you have this whole thing where a whole dehumanization of particularly the African people, but to a certain extent, as time goes on, the Native peoples as well, a dehumanization and the training in the most violent interaction with people that you can imagine.
Yeah. one of the key elements to telling the story is just being honest about it. And the colleges not only take money from slavery and the slave trade, and they not only have slave traders on their boards of trustees and among their founders, in fact, lots of them. When I started this, I thought the thing that would be difficult to find would be the connections between the trustees and the slave trade. And in fact, it was one of the easiest things because the trustees were often slave traders. So it was an immediate connection. It wasn't something that was sort of, you know, that you had to follow some path to get to. And so not only do they take that money, not only are the students often the sons of slave traders and planters, and the money is coming out of these regions of the world, but you also, in fact, have the active participation of the campuses in many of these sort of wars of empire. And I'll go back to the Pequot War in 1637. Harvard is too young, too immature, and too ephemeral to really participate in that war. But the beginnings of Harvard are really sort of stabilized by that war. When the English, when the Puritans conquer the Pequot, one of the things that happens in the aftermath is they divide up Pequot territory. Remember, they sell all those women and children, they have the massacre, but they also divide up Pequot territory. Well, Harvard gets 2,000 acres of land from that, which becomes part of its endowment and part of what allows it to remain stable. And in fact, it'll acquire land for much of the next century as the Puritans continue to expand into Indian country. By 1675, when King Philip's War breaks out in New England 40 years later, now Harvard is in fact a relatively stable but still small colonial college. It's supplying the colonial government, and Harvard graduates and Harvard students participate in every aspect of King Philip's War. They're everywhere. The children who enter Harvard in the next century are the children of the veterans of the Pequot War. And so universities, colleges, and warfare are in fact tied together fairly early in colonial history. And you're absolutely right. One of the things that's happening on campus is the colleges don't invent the idea that people of color are less than human. That's actually invented in the nasty, miserable business of enslaving people and violently conquering them. But what the colleges do is they refine those ideas and they give them intellectual legitimacy. And that's a key role of the college in shaping the intellectual culture of the Americas that sustains both colonialism and slavery.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me first remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Craig Stephen Wilder, professor of American history at MIT, and the author of a really fabulous book, a really powerful book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. Now, I want to move into something that's a little bit different, but it sort of takes us a little further. At that period of time, you had tremendous changes happening in the world. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you had was you had the Enlightenment going on in a certain sense, in science in particular. But you had this irony, and you mention it in the book, you had this irony of all of these people, these universities, these, as we said, the elite universities, the people that are really the sort of the backbone of civilization in the Americas. You have this whole thing where in the midst of all these really important things going on and what could be liberating in a certain sense, mm-hmm. in terms of mental, getting rid of the mental shackles and whatnot, you have all of that. But you also have at the same time the greatest atrocities happening. How did that play out in relation to these universities? Because here they are, they're all, Harvard and Yale and you've got the people with you see all the pictures that are in your book and it's like, wow, these are really, talk about stuffed shirts. These guys really look like it, but at the same time, and everybody's always like, well, you go to Harvard or Yale or Dartmouth or anywhere, you're a brainiac, right? Right. And the whole point of you have this enlightenment, you have all the possibility, but you have the most venal things going on, and it's a terrible irony there.
Yeah, and I think it's something hard for us to often wrestle with because we want an either or. We want the Enlightenment as a period of sort of intellectual expansion, and that tends toward both political and physical liberty. But that's actually inconsistent with some other facts that are just really quite inconvenient but inescapable. The age of the Enlightenment is also the beginning of genocidal warfare. It includes the peak of the Atlantic slave trade and Atlantic slavery. And so you have, in fact, these violent and grotesque contradictions to this sort of this notion of an intellectual culture that's tending toward greater human liberty and greater respect for the individual. And I would argue that it's not really inconsistent, that rooted in the Enlightenment project is also, in fact, underwriting much of the Enlightenment project is conquest, colonialism, and slavery. And so universities aren't just expanding in the Americas at the peak of the slave trade. We have to remember that universities in Europe are also expanding at the peak of the slave trade. You know, the very planters in the West Indies, the William Codrington, who leaves part of his estate to the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in the early 18th century and eventually establishes Codrington College, which I mentioned in Barbados. Codrington also gives to his alma mater, Oxford University, and the British universities, the French universities, the Dutch universities, Spanish universities are actually also benefiting from Atlantic slavery and the slave trade, and they're consuming the products being produced by the Americas. And I don't mean the, you know, the physical products, the intellectual products, including things like race and racism. They're actually beginning to help in the project of, or take over the project of refining those ideas and giving them legitimacy. And so part of the Enlightenment project itself is wrestling with human difference, human variation, but also the vulgar, violent, often grotesque inequalities and brutalities of the world in which the Enlightenment emerges.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind people that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Craig Stephen Wilder, who's the author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled Histories of America's Universities. You know, a really great book, and I really recommend people get this and study it, all right, and think about it a lot, because it's just going to open your head up. You know, Craig, before we move into one thing here, I wanted to also ask you this, because I always appreciate someone who is fearless in the search for truth, okay? And in particular, I have to tell you, I loved what you did to Jefferson and Franklin, what they did to themselves, but the fact that you didn't try to cover up what these people were about, because a lot of people might say, well, that was all this stuff was like when England was running the show and this was happening, and this was happening. But actually, you had these people who were, in fact, slaveholders themselves, and not only were slaveholders, but actually didn't really apologize for it. They didn't really think there was all that much wrong with it, you know, no matter what the popular mythology is today. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I found the one thing about, particularly around Jefferson, about the orangutan question, which was I mean, you know, you read it and you're like, what? Wait a minute, you know?
Yeah. You know, and part of what I wanted to do for readers was to show them how these ideas, how ideas about race and notions of the biological, cultural, and physical inequality of colored people got crafted and then sort of refined in the Atlantic world. And it's an amazing project. When I started this, I actually had thought, a lot of it is in the chapters where I talk about the first medical colleges in the American colonies, the first one being in Philadelphia and the second one in New York. And what I had thought when I went into it was that American students, students from the colonies, were going to Europe to study medicine. And in Europe, they were actually learning about race and coming back. But what I found out when I went to both the American college archives and the European colleges was actually that that's not quite how it worked. The American students in the 1750s, for instance, and 1760s, a lot of young men from the Americas were going to European universities to study medicine. But very often when they emerged on the other side of the Atlantic, they emerged as experts and were treated as experts on race because they had intimate knowledge of Africans and Native Americans. They grew up near Native Americans. They grew up with slaves. They were coming from plantations, and they were the sons of slave traders and planters. They were coming out of the West Indies. They were coming out of Virginia. You know, there were enough Virginians at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland to form a Virginia Club in the 18th century. You know, that's how many of these young wealthy boys there are. And so what you see, actually, when you look at the archives in, for instance, Edinburgh or in London, is you actually see a lot of young American colonial students refining ideas about race and contributing to the race discourse. You know, one of them, you know, William Byrd actually gets the other side of Virginian, gets the other side of the Atlantic and starts giving lectures on what's effectively vitiligo among black people. Another gives a lecture on albinism among Native Americans. But in fact, they're often treated as experts, and they're often treated as people who carry extraordinary information. So to come back to Jefferson, Jefferson is actually contributing to this process. Jefferson, in Notes on Virginia, writes that he went out to an Indian mound, a burial site, with his slaves and had them break open graves so that he could collect Indian remains and send to his friends who were researchers in Europe. He also begins to, in that same book, Notes on the State of Virginia, begins to write about and speculate about the biological differences between Africans, Native Americans, and Europeans. And this is where he starts comparing black women to the orangutan, or in fact, what he writes is that the bestiality, effectively, of black people can be proven by the fact that the male orangutan prefers black women to females of its own species. This is an idea that not only attracted Jefferson intellectually, that he liked intellectually, But it's an idea that he'd actually taken from another publication, which was just a few years earlier, the Jamaican planter Edward Long, who did a history of Jamaica, and, you know, included in it a sort of description of the racial civilization of Jamaica as it emerged, uses, in fact, that exact comparison. And Jefferson was a student of and a consumer of the race mythologies of the Atlantic world, which people like Jefferson, who imagined themselves to be intellectuals and part of the intellectual project of the Enlightenment, were refining and popularizing.
All right, Craig, we're going to take a quick station break, give you a chance to recover and think and rest up a little bit, maybe get a drink of water, and then we'll come back and continue the conversation for a little bit. Is that all right?
Great. Okay, that sounds great. Fantastic.
Liberation is a must. Ay, 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 ay. Oh, well, now, yeah. Slavery, oh, slavery. We still living in slavery. Slavery, oh, slavery, yeah. Look around, it's still slavery. Slavery won't provide a job. Slavery driving the people mad.
All right. Welcome back. That's Ross Shiloh with Slavery. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Craig Stephen Wilder. Craig is a professor of history, American history at MIT, and he's the author of a really heavy, very important book called Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. And when we left, we were just talking about Jefferson. I have to say, too, you know, Franklin, who is always presented as like the funny old guy that's like, you know, a harebrained genius who, you know, wears his little glasses and loves everybody.
Right.
Actually, he was pretty damn, didn't like black people a whole lot.
Well, you know, I mean, there's a Franklin we know and there's the Franklin we don't know. And the Franklin we know is the guy who's in Paris, who everybody loves because he's an intellectual and he's relatively secular. And so he fits into the mood of pre-revolutionary Paris quite well. And then there's also the Benjamin Franklin, who is effectively a lifelong slave owner, who opposes slavery at the end of his life, but actually, as one of his biographer notes, never actually emancipates anyone.
Right.
So we talk about him as the founder of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society, but we often fail to mention that all of his slaves either ran away or they died his slaves, or he died and they remained enslaved. And there's also the Franklin, who by the 1750s is deeply enmeshed in the emerging project of defending conquest and colonialism, and who's part of the project. And I don't want to make it sound conspiratorial, because it's not. It's actually the evolution of a body of cultural and intellectual ideas that attend to and respond to conquest, colonialism, and the violent realities of conquest and slavery. But he's part of an intellectual project which is coming to justify slavery and conquest, at least in the extent to which it actually comes to affirm the racial distinctions that allow those trades to be carried on. And so, for instance, the Franklin of the 1750s is part of a generation who are predicting the extinction, if not extermination, of Native people in the Americas. And that's an extraordinary moment. I write about it in the book because I think we all need to remember that in the 18th century there emerged an extraordinarily dangerous idea, vision of the future of the Americas without, in fact, Native people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Now we have time, I think, for one more question. And I don't know how to actually, I'm going to try and put three or four of them together. Sure. But the point about what you began talking about, American students flocking to Europe, especially going to Scotland, Edinburgh, going to medical school there, learning science. You make in the book, you make this point that says race did not come from science and theology, but came to science and theology. I wanted you to explain that, because that's the sort of, you got this rise out of that whole time when people were going and they were learning things that were very new and very real in some cases. There was a real progressive aspect to what was going on in Edinburgh. Then you also had the rise of scientific racism when you come back to the States. This is something, a contradiction I wanted to explore a little bit.
Yeah, part of what I wanted readers to remember or to really emphasize was that there's a notion that we often talk about racial science and theological racism as if, in fact, race comes out of those. Those are the vehicles that produce race. And I wanted people to remember that actually it's real people becoming scientists and then imposing upon this emerging body of practices that we call science, racialized beliefs that transform the intellectual culture. And you can see it with the young Americans who are actually in Scotland in the 1760s. You know, they're actually racing the Philadelphians and the New Yorkers are basically in a competition to see who'll get back first and establish the first medical school, and the Philadelphians win. The Philadelphia is a more logical site for it, actually, because intellectually, it's a more sophisticated city, certainly in the 1760s, and more receptive to the Scottish Enlightenment tradition that these kids are studying in, these young men are studying in. But they race back. But the thing that I want readers to remember is when they get back to establish those schools, the way that they establish them is by getting access to the corpses and the bodies of enslaved people and Native Americans. And so the Philadelphia Project begins when the colonial government transfers the body of a Negro to the school so they can practice upon him. In New York, the Columbia Medical School, which is the second one in the colonies, rents its laboratories and instruction rooms in New York Hospital, which is situated directly across the street from the Negro's burial ground. And the students raid the burial grounds for the corpses and cadavers. At Dartmouth College, when they established their medical school, one of the first steps to its establishment is the personal physician of the founding president, Eliezer Wheelock. Wheelock shows up to New Hampshire with 8 slaves when he establishes Dartmouth, right? He has more slaves than students. He's got more slaves than faculty, and he's got more slaves than trustees. But his personal physician takes the corpse, the body of a deceased black man, skins it, removes the entire skin from it, boils the body in a pot to separate the flesh from the bone, and then wires the bone together for instructional purposes, for a skeleton, for instructional purposes in classes. And then he takes the entire skin and has it tanned like leather so it can be used for instructional purposes. He actually uses it to dress his instrument case, to basically wrap his instrument case in the flesh of a human being. But that's the brutal, ugly reality of the establishment of medicine in the Americas, and why I argue, in fact, in the book, that the project of establishing science is intertwined with the brutalities of slavery and conquest.
Mm-hmm. And I lied. I have about one question I wanted to ask you that we only have about a minute to answer
Okay, I'll do it quick.
And this is very important because you talked about when people came back from Europe as well, when they came back from Scotland, that the rise of science to the extent that science supplanted theology, it eroded the remnants of ecclesiastical control of the academy, but often then brought its own rationalizing of slavery as part of a natural process. That it underwrote the production of knowledge and it distorted the knowable.
Right, right. That, in fact, actually what you have, certainly by the end of the 18th century and the early 19th century, is you actually start to have a competition between science and theology to see which tradition, which intellectual site is the best site for defending slavery and defending the brutalities of the colonial world. And ultimately, science wins. And I show why in the book, how it comes to win, by in fact asserting that it was the superior position for making provable, reproducible claims about human beings, and so that it supplants what it will describe as the mythologies of theology with the truths of academic science. But those truths are, in fact, truths that ultimately are in defense of slavery and conquest. And because of that, it means that, remember, the very people who are founding the medical schools are the same families, or funding the establishment, are the same families that are the same slave trading families that are establishing the schools. And so their presence distorts what can be known. And you can actually see that process play out on campus as ideas, in fact, get rejected. And in fact, as more humanitarian ideas, ideas about the equality of human beings, which are also rooted in the Enlightenment, get crushed on campus, and this campus becomes a site for actually stopping those conversations.
Mm-hmm. And something that I have to add is that for people who think, oh, well, that was then, this is now, you know what? There's a whole lot of knuckleheads in this country that still, because of the impact of this, the way this stuff gets propagated, that still believe a lot of the bull that was propagated by this whole development of the universities and its ties with slavery.
And universities still participate actively in cultures of inequality and injustice.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, Craig, thank you very much for joining us today.
I so appreciate it.
Craig, talk to you again soon, I hope.
I hope so.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Craig Stephen Wilder. Craig is a professor of American history at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he's the author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue with our theme this week. And we're going to be listening to an excerpt from a talk by Bob Avakian. Now, the subject of this talk is going to be American democracy, white supremacy, and slavery, the slavery that ran underneath and stood behind American democracy when this country was first formed and continues to shape it all the way up to today. So stay tuned. ¶¶ Welcome back. This is the Michael Slate Show, and that was Slave Song from David Murray. Yep, David Murray, jazzman extraordinaire. You know, I put a lot of thought into where we could go with this second segment of today's show, keeping in line with the theme. And I decided that we need to keep on digging for some truth on this issue. I started the show off with a quote from Avakian that was drawn from the book Basics. It's the quote that opens up the book Basics. And that quote said, "There would be no United States as we now know it today without slavery." That is a simple and basic truth. Simple, basic, and true. But think how controversial this is. We live in a country built on and sustained by lies and distortions. At best, we're told that slavery was an unfortunate stain on the sacred democratic fabric of this country. We're told to pay more attention to that hero of equality, freedom, and democracy for all, Thomas Jefferson, than to the slaveocracy that this country was built on and that continues to influence it today. We're told to disregard the cranks who place too much emphasis on the past, to just get over slavery. And more commonly these days, our schools are even teaching children that the Civil War was not about slavery, but about states' rights. Well, I hope this excerpt from Avakian's talk, Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy, can bang a few holes in all that. So let's take a listen.
In reality, Jefferson's agrarian society turned out to be a society based on slavery and ruled by slave owners. One striking example that a number of people have pointed to in this regard is the Louisiana Purchase. Napoleon, having suffered some military defeats, reckoned that he couldn't easily hold on to these territory that became part of the Louisiana Purchase by the U.S. under Jefferson. And so Jefferson stepped in to quickly grab up this territory, to purchase it. And he did so primarily in the interest of the slave owners and in order to spread the slave-owning system into those new territories, not to develop an agrarian society based on a multitude of small, yeoman, independent farmers. And this is just one example of many that are spoken to in some of those books that I referred to of how Jefferson consistently acted not in the interests of these yeoman small farmers, but in the interests of the slave-owning class, even as not only as against the yeomen, but also their interests in conflict with those of the rising capitalist class in the North. Along with the economic dimension, the whole Southern way of life was one that depended on slavery. That was its fundamental economic basis. Even small landowners who didn't own slaves strived to get into a position to own some. And in a more personal dimension, Jefferson's political fortunes, including his election to the presidency itself, depended on slavery. And in particular, as I've spoken to elsewhere, the three-fifths provision in the Constitution, the so-called three-fifths compromise that said that slaves, for the purposes both of taxation but also of election and representation, would be counted as three-fifths of people. And as many Northerners pointed out at the time, coming from various positions and with various motives, this essentially allowed the Southern states to, by the ownership of property in the form of slaves, accumulate a lot of more votes or representation in the government by the multiplication of this property, which, of course, Northern owners of property, for example, farms or small factories, didn't get to count each factory in terms of how much representation the state would have. But the slave states got to count three-fifths of each of the slave, the total of each all the slaves, in terms of representation in the government. So this tilted things toward the Southern states in terms of the political structure from the beginning of the country. And in fact, if you look into this, you'll see that this was something that the Southern states insisted upon, or there would have been no union. There would have been no United States. And even those in the North who, on basis of moral conviction and or economic interest, were opposed to slavery, ended up capitulating to this, because otherwise the South would have refused to join in the Union and there would have been no United States. regardless of the war against England and the Declaration of Independence and all that. When it came down to it, this was a sine qua non. This was an absolute requirement for the slave-owning class in the South. And it did involve a compromise, but this compromise embodied the things that I've been speaking to, which gave a certain disproportionate power to the South, to the slave-owning class, and which enabled them to block and counter moves that would have gone in the direction of abolishing slavery. Sometimes it's claimed by, in fact, it's claimed quite often by different people that Jefferson was actually opposed to slavery and wanted to see an end to it. And you can find statements by Jefferson where he says that slavery is, in fact, a blight and that it will have the consequences down the road and so on, of a negative kind down the road and so on. And also, there have been misinterpretations of what Jefferson wrote about slavery, some of which didn't get into the final version of the Declaration of Independence, where he denounced in strong terms the, some of it did get in and some of it didn't, but denunciation in strong terms of the King of England and of the British government for supposedly imposing the slave trade on the United States. And there were ways in which Jefferson and the Virginia slave-owning class in particular were opposed to aspects of the slave trade, that is, the international slave trade, because they themselves were involved in selling slaves to other states and slave owners in other territories. And they didn't want the price of the slaves being driven down. And this is the reason fundamentally that they were opposed to the continuation, once they did oppose it, of the international slave trade. They view this entirely in property and supply and demand terms. So in reality, once again on this point, Jefferson acted in the interest of the slave-owning class, and his agrarian society turned out to be a slave-owning plantation society in reality, not a society of small, independent farming yeomen. Now, this is, of course, related to, in an overall sense, part of the larger contradiction between Jefferson's lofty-sounding statements in the Declaration of Independence about the equality of all men, note all men, and their inalienable rights, and on the other hand, the glaring fact that Jefferson not only owned slaves himself, but, as I've pointed to, consistently acted on behalf of the class of slave owners, and in upholding the institution of slavery, even while voicing certain moral qualms and objections to slavery, and recognizing that it strategically embodied many problems and dangers for the new American Republic. This, again, was a very acute contradiction.
A quick reminder, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're listening to an excerpt from Bob Avakian's talk, Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. The subject of this excerpt is built around how Jefferson's ideal society was a reality of slavery and everything that brings with it.
Historian Edward S. Morgan, in American Slavery, American Freedom, which is cited in David Bryan Davis's book, In Human Bondage, argues that for Jefferson and other Virginian slave owners, such as George Washington and James Madison, the latter being the principal author of the U.S. Constitution, and also Madison himself became president of the United States, for figures like this, there was a certain kind of unity, a unity of opposites, as we would say, between how they viewed whites and, on the other hand, black Africans, mulattoes, and Indians. And I'm going to quote from Morgan and give a little explanation of what he's saying here to make it a little clearer. Morgan says, quote, "Racism thus absorbed in Virginia the fear and contempt that men of the upper classes in Europe, whether Whig or Tory," that is, today we would say whether liberal or conservative, "felt for the inarticulate lower classes of whites or Europeans." In other words, he's saying here that this, in Europe, there was an open contempt on the part of the upper ruling classes and their political representatives for the inarticulate and ignorant rabble of the lower classes. But in the United States, the same thing did not find exactly the same expression, because a lot of this contempt was, if you want to put it that way, deflected and directed toward the masses of black people who were enslaved, and to, you know, overwhelmingly, especially in the South, and toward mulattoes and Indians. And then Morgan goes on. Racism made it possible for white Virginians to develop, and this is very significant in terms of the whole development of bourgeois democracy in this country. Racism made it possible for white Virginians to develop a devotion to liberty, for whites we should underline, that English Republicans had declared to be the soul of liberty. In other words, because of racism and because of excluding, essentially, from consideration as human beings deserving of freedom, of classes or groups of people such as Africans, mulattoes, and Indians, they could, at the same time, without feeling an acute contradiction, articulate, as Jefferson did in the Declaration of Independence, lofty principles of the equality of and inalienable rights of all people. They were speaking about all white people, and more specifically, all white men, dead or otherwise. And they were explicitly excluding from this these other groups of people that I've referred to, most especially the African people of African origin. And so the one went together with the other. They could feel, in large part exactly because of this exclusion, that they were speaking in a universal way about freedom, even while they represented certain particular interests, certain particular class interests, even among the whites. There was a dialectical unity there. By excluding these other groups, they could feel, even while they represented the interests of the ruling classes among whites, they could feel they were speaking in universal terms about the freedoms for all people who were not excluded, i.e. the whites. This is a very important insight. And then he goes on. He speaks about Republicans, and he doesn't mean the ruling right-wing party in the U.S. today, but people who have a Republican philosophy of government. That is to say, the general political philosophical viewpoint that is opposed, for example, to a monarchy, the best and most just form of government is a republic in which the people are said to be sovereign and have the formal right to vote and elect representatives to government in whatever form that takes place. So these people, in other words, could proclaim Republican principles and believe in them even while practicing and defending slavery as well as other forms of exploitation. And Morgan goes on, by lumping Indians, mulattoes, and Negroes in a single pariah class, that is, putting them in a category of people who were not really to be considered human in terms of the rights and freedoms that human beings should have. By lumping Indians, mulattoes, and Negroes in a single pariah class, Virginians, and here he's speaking about ruling class slave-owning Virginians in particular, Virginians had paved the way for a similar lumping of small and large planters in a single master class. Here again you see the unity between the exclusion of one and the notion of unity of all the others, even with the class divisions among them. And Morgan continues, racism became an essential, if unacknowledged, ingredient of the Republican ideology that enabled Virginians, like Jefferson and Madison as well as Washington, to lead the nation. And this is a peculiarity or particularity of the development of bourgeois society and the principles of bourgeois democracy as they developed from the very beginning and have evolved historically in the United States. As David Bryan Davis summed it up in his recent book on slavery, Inhuman Bondage, quote, according to Morgan, racial slavery enabled Virginia's slave-owning planter class to co-opt the poorer whites and thus perpetuate a highly exploitative and unequal society under the banner of Republican liberty. And this is something very important to understand, not only in terms of the history of the founding of the country and the basis on which it was founded, but in terms of its implications and in terms of its consequences down through the history of the country, even to today. So with whatever limitations there may be in Morgan's and in Davis's overall analysis, there is definitely important truth to the fact that, first of all, the Republican ideology and notions of freedom that have characterized the way in which the United States has been conceived and ruled have indeed included racism and the oppression of black people and others whom today are often called people of color, the exclusion of them from the very beginning, from this notion of freedom, and their oppression from the very beginning and in the very foundation of the country. And there has been a definite tendency for this to contribute in various ways to blunting the overall class conflicts in society and the class consciousness of the proletarians, among the whites in particular, but also in a different way among black people and other oppressed nationalities. So all that's by way of speaking to the first irony that I mentioned, that Jefferson talked about a virtuous yeoman-based agrarian society, but actually in opposition to that, consistently upheld and fought for the interests of the slave-owning class and the agrarian society that in reality he was an embodiment and a spokesperson for, was a slave-owning plantation society.
All right, once again, that was Bob Avakian talking about slavery, white supremacy, and democracy in America. And that was taken from his talk, Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy.
All right, and you can find the full talk at revcom.us. That's revcom.us. And if you go to that website, you'll see a section on Bob Avakian where you'll find all the audio talks, video, and other works, including a major new work,
The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible.
All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. You want to write to me, you can, at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with something very special from Van Morrison. It's called Educating Archie. Check this out.
Slave.